It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Family members of drug overdose victims share their stories through obituaries, and legislation in both Harrisburg and Washington would restrict abortions to no later than 20 weeks pregnancy. That's coming up later in the program. But first, it's been a busy couple of weeks for the beleaguered Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. A major fine from the Department of Environmental Protection. State lawmakers pass a bill to give the Public Utility Commission oversight. And a consultant sends recommendations to an advisory panel on how to restructure PWSA. Let's get to all of that with Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporter Bob Bowder and WESA's infrastructure and development reporter Margaret J. Krause. Welcome back to the program, you two.
Thanks, Kevin.
Pleasure to be here.
As always, your input is encouraged. You can tweet us your comments or questions. Please use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, let's start with that fine from the Pennsylvania DEP, $2.4 million. Why? Why the fine?
Well, PWSA has had a long history of violations, upsetting the DEP. And I think they just finally levied that fine to say, look, we need you to start doing stuff we want you to do.
And PWSA knew it was coming down the pike, despite the fact that the language from DEP is not particularly fuzzy. You know, it reads pretty scary. PWSA knew it was coming. They were working with DEP. And DEP said, you know, we're going to levy this fine. But instead of just having it come to our coffers, we would prefer that it go to make changes in the community. So a significant portion of the money is going to replace lead lines in the city.
Right. So the reason for the fine, was it high lead levels in the water? Was it a replacement of the lead lines? What was it for? What did they fail to do?
All of the above, really. They cited the high lead levels. They cited the fact that, well, the city some months ago declared a moratorium on replacing lead line, partial lead line replacements, which means they would replace their lead line, but a homeowner who might have a lead line going into the home, PWSA said it did not have the authority to replace that line. And when they replaced their line, it increased the levels of lead in the home. It unleashed more lead into the home. So the city declared a moratorium on it, and DEP had ordered them to replace so many lead lines a year, and that was one of the things that went into the fine.
So they didn't want to exacerbate the lead in the water, but they were afraid if they did replace the lead lines, they would do just that.
Right, and what the DEP said to me was, well, there were lines they could have replaced that wouldn't have been a partial line replacement that would have then spiked lead levels. And the other thing is, too, that PWSA still doesn't have a firm grasp on where all the lead lines are, what the makeup is of all the lines in the city, which is part of the DEP consent order and agreement to continue mapping all of the materials in the city.
All right. Now, much of the concerns, we talked about lead levels in the water, much of the concerns of Pittsburghers have to do with lead in their water. And PWSA announced, I believe it was this week or late last week, that it planned to hire a company to restructure its testing lab. Why do we need to restructure that, too? What's the purpose?
So PWSA is not currently certified. Its lab is not certified. And so they have to send out testing to a company to do testing. And CWM, which is the company who's going to come in and do training, institute new methods, and get PWSA recertified, they had been one of the recipients of PWSA's testing. So they're familiar. And the idea is to reinvest basically back in PWSA's lab so they can do all of the testing needed for regulatory compliance in-house.
All right. So a couple of questions. That brings up a couple of questions. Will this expedite the testing procedure and results? Will it save money? And the third question, will Pittsburghers trust PWSA testing the water? Bob, tackle any of those.
Well, in terms of trust, I think they have a pretty big challenge to overcome in terms of trust, because of the billing problems that have happened in the past, because of the lead levels, and because of the customer service. And typical Pittsburghers don't trust PWSA. There was a councilwoman who said publicly she wouldn't believe anything they tell her. So that's a pretty big challenge for PWSA.
Well, trust is hard to build and easy to lose. But I think going to these meetings, both PWSA meetings, meetings of the Blue Ribbon Panel, and the consultant who's trying to recommend to the Blue Ribbon Panel how PWSA could be restructured, is that it's sort of this moment of radical honesty. I don't know how people will respond to it, but basically PWSA saying, we know it's messed up. We know it's been messed up for a long time. Here's what we're doing. We welcome more eyes looking at this. So I don't know how people will feel, but certainly it seems as though they're trying.
Yeah, despite PWSA, as far as the lab goes, say this will save money and expedite the process or not?
Bob Weimer said in the board meeting where it was approved to hire CWM that it would be about the same cost if they were going to make similar investments on their own into the lab. And so they're bringing in this level of expertise. And CWM's director says that this is to do more and more lead testing, which is coming down the pike. They're going to need people who can tackle the volume, and they're ready to tackle that volume.
All right.
We should also note that there are vacancies in the lab. And Bob Weimer, the interim executive director, wants to fill them with talented people that know what they're doing, and they want to do it quickly.
Okay. So earlier this week, Governor Wolf indicated that he would sign legislation passed by the Pennsylvania House and Senate that would give the Public Utility Commission oversight of PWSA. What does this mean? And just how much looking over the shoulder of PWSA would the PUC be doing?
Well, rate increases are one thing that PUC will oversee. And PWSA in the future is going to have to make a case before PUC as to why they need a rate increase, just like the other utilities do. That's a major factor. And it was something that was cited by the city in saying, we won't mind if the PUC comes in.
Okay. So rate increases, how does this apply to the announced, three annual rate increases? Do we know yet? Or, in other words, can it be retroactive, the PUC oversight, or will PWSA have to go and say, well, here's what we announced, now we need you to approve it? Do we know that yet?
I don't know about that. I'm not sure whether they'll, because you're right, they announced we're going to increase rates. It'll be approximately a 56% increase through 2020. I don't know if they'll have to go claw that back.
I think that the first year's increase will go into effect, but they may have to go before PUC for the second 2 years of that that series, increases.
So because, maybe the first would take effect.
Because oversight doesn't start until April of 2018.
Ah, okay. So the bill was approved overwhelmingly in both chambers. Was there any concern expressed about here's another level of government getting involved? Did we hear anything like that? I mean, you mentioned that Mayor Peduto said he didn't oppose this.
Right, and they've consistently said that since the bill was introduced. There is another bill that was proposed by State Rep Dom Costa would create another level of oversight similar to the Intergovernmental Cooperation Authority that continues to oversee city finances.
Under Act 47, yeah.
I'm
saying the city's oversight is under Act 47.
Exactly. Yeah. And the administration and city officials are vehemently opposed to that.
Yeah.
Right, receivership.
Yes.
And the response was, one of the concerns about restructuring PWSA, however it happens, has been how much control remains at the local level. Mayor Peduto and Bob Weimer, the interim executive director of PWSA, said, no, we welcome the additional oversight. But receivership, the Blue Ribbon Panel, has said, well, that seems silly. We lose basically all control then.
All right. You brought up the Blue Ribbon Panel. And this week, IMG, Infrastructure Management Group, delivered its recommendations report for restructuring PWSA to that mayoral Blue Ribbon Panel. So remind us briefly again, who is IMG? What was their charge?
Well, they're based in Maryland. They're a company that specializes in water and sewer management. And they were brought in to take an overall look at PWSA operations and come up with recommendations for how PWSA could fix its problems, basically, and restructure if necessary.
And Margaret, this Blue Ribbon Advisory Panel, they were all appointed by the mayor, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, okay. So now they have it. Now, one of the recommendations, let's get to a couple of the big recommendations. One of the recommendations from IMG has to do with governance. If accepted, the PWSA board would be replaced by a public trust. What would this public trust do? What would its responsibilities? Do we know that?
It essentially, so, the right. So the PWSA board would be dissolved.
Okay.
And the way that it works in Indianapolis, which is what this is kind of structured like or recommended to be like, is there's a board of trustees and there's a board of directors. And the board of trustees, so it's like a, they call it a self-perpetuating system. The board of trustees then picks the board of directors. So it's still functioning like a board. It's still a layer of oversight, a layer of, you know, long-term planning, et cetera, et cetera. But it's unclear to me who appoints the board of trustees, who's then responsible for appointing the board of directors.
Right. So, and Mayor Peduto told me that the mayor would lose appointing privileges or authority. He also said that means that that could help depoliticize the system.
Presently, many of the board members by city code are required to be city employees. This would then take away those and potentially replace them with citizens of different parts of the community.
So, would it depoliticize? Do we know that yet, or we have to wait to see who is on this public trust?
Well, the city or the board of directors of PWSA would appoint the first board of trustees, and then that board of trustees would, as Margaret said, perpetuate itself by they would appoint another board. The board of trustees itself would appoint a board, and it would continue in that way for as long as they're a public trust.
Okay.
And I think in all of these things that are being discussed, it depends on how it's written. So depending on how it's chartered, it would determine what the structures are, what the rules of governance are.
Okay. One of the other big words, had to do with leasing. And leasing the infrastructure, leasing the day-to-day operations. So what do the proponents say is the benefits of leasing the system, whether it's day-to-day operations or their actual infrastructure?
Well, Jeffs, I have not heard what may happen to current employees if that is the situation. If you bring in a company, for example, to take over your infrastructure maintenance, what happens to the PWSA employees that do that now? Now, presumably, they would be let go, and you would pay an outside company to do this so you wouldn't have the legacy costs and that kind of thing right off the top. You'd have a flat fee of some sort to do this.
Would this help because PWSA is so much in debt and the amount of money needed to really fix the problem over the next 10, 12, we even hear 30 years is beyond what they can borrow? I mean, in a sense, the system is underwater, pun intended. But would this help having a private leaser be able to invest in the infrastructure?
I think it's one way. I don't know that we've, because all these things are still yet to be decided on, I think some of the details haven't even been discussed yet. So there's a possibility that it could, depending on how it's written. The way that the infrastructure lease was explained to me is that that PWSA and whatever new form it is, if it is a public trust, would set the expectations for that private company. So they would say, if you do X amount of work, then we make this payment. If you don't, you swallow that cost. And in that sense, you lose the headache of the legacy costs. You get to see work done. You have a fixed cost that you know of, so long as that private company meets their expectation. But maybe there are other ways it could be structured that would be just as helpful, that would allow more control to remain with PWSA. I'm not sure. I think a lot of these things are still being discussed.
PWSA has had some experience with private operators. 2012, it hired a private firm, Veolia. The company ran operations for, I believe it was like 3.5 years. That ended badly. It's still in legal dispute. I asked the mayor, why should Pittsburghers trust leasing the system after the troubles with Veolia?
Well, the Veolia contract was written horribly. all of the money that they ended up saving should have been going into the infrastructure, ended up going back into their pockets because of the contract that was written. Veolia was a contract that was written by a company. We'll be writing it for the people.
Bob?
Well, they certainly have to dot their I's and cross their T's in any kind of contract, I would say. That's up in the air, really.
We're finding out now a lot's up in the air.
Well, one of the things, there was a fairly large demonstration, I'd say maybe 45, 50 people, before the last presentation IMG made to the Blue Ribbon panel. And their main push was, this is our water. We elect you. We want you, and therefore us, to be the ultimate voice on the water. This is our water. Do not, you know, make it a thing that's generating profit. So to a lot of people, an infrastructure lease remains privatization. And I think Veolia, right, cost saving, it went to them. Whereas if you say to someone, we expect you to fix 10% of the lines and then we pay you, that's a different setup. So I think there's still a lot of concern.
And we should also note that PWSA has already taken steps to try to address some of these problems on their own. They raised the rates, which is going to bring in more revenue.
Right.
They've accelerated their capital projects that the DEP said they want immediately addressed. And so, meanwhile, while all this is going on down at PWSA, they're working to try to resolve their issues.
And board chairwoman Debbie Listishan said, we can't, you know, this is all great, but we can't wait. We are moving forward and we're taking steps to fix the problems that we know we have.
All right, moving forward. So what are the next steps in this process regarding the recommendations by IMG? What do we know is next up?
So the Blue Ribbon panel has the final report from IMG. They have to read it, digest it, and then they end up having to make recommendations to the mayor and city council. That's the sort of next immediate step.
And it ultimately goes back to the board at PWSA. PWSA board must agree with anything, any changes that are made.
Because they jointly hired with the city IMG.
They jointly paid for it, yes.
Yes.
Okay. So, mayor said that restructuring could begin as early as next year. IMG said it hoped it would be completed by the end of 2018. So a year from now, when we are sitting in this studio, is that major change already going to be in place or on its way?
I would think that parts of it are going to be moving. Whether they can do the whole thing in that short period of time, I don't know.
And short period of time for this major change is really a year.
I mean, there are a lot of moving parts in the physical system as well as the overall system. So I'll be interested to keep an eye on it.
And specifically, what will you two be keeping an eye on regarding the next steps?
Well, the main question here is, will the Blue Ribbon panel recommend going along with the trust, or will it say, hey, PWSA board seems to be moving in the right direction. Maybe no change is needed.
Margaret?
Yeah, I'm going to be watching the money. I want to see how the capital plan that they've built plays out.
All right. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's infrastructure and development reporter. Bob Bowder is Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporter. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks. Thank you, Kevin.
Coming up, families dealing with the overdose deaths of loved ones are turning more and more to writing candid obituaries. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. A new documentary will explore the life of Fred Rogers, especially how he navigated cultural and social issues. Won't You Be My Neighbor hits the big screen in June, which happens to be the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And if the moon appears bigger Sunday night, your eyes aren't deceiving you. December 3rd will bring a supermoon, making the nighttime celestial orb look about 14% larger. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last year, 4,600 people died from opioid overdoses in Pennsylvania. We often talk about, report on the dramatic increase in the number of victims, sweeping arrests of dealers, using Medicaid dollars to expand treatment services, and cracking down on doctor shopping for legal but still potentially deadly painkillers, which are often a conduit to the illegal opioids. But one thing we do not hear much about is families avoiding talking about their loved ones' addictions and even deaths as a result of opioids. We're going to discuss that with Megan Guza, reporter with the Tribune Review, and Andrew Russell, photojournalist with the Trib, whose major report was published Thursday online. Folks, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So let's start with, how did you learn about people who were quiet, maybe even afraid of the stigma of addiction, and then beginning to open up and start talking, but doing it through obituaries that they wrote for their loved one?
It started with a Twitter feed that I happened across one day called Faces of Overdose, where all it does is just tweet out links to obituaries in which addiction and overdose are mentioned. And I was like, oh my gosh, there are a lot of these, and there are a lot from Pennsylvania and a lot from southwestern Pennsylvania. So I used those to pull names and just started reaching out to families from there.
Andrew, were you surprised when you first came upon this?
Yeah, I was. Megan and I have been covering this epidemic for about a year now, and a constant theme is the idea of shame and the stigmatizing of addiction. So the idea that people were becoming more public about it was kind of a surprise.
What did you learn? Did the story vary from person to person that you talked to? Was the opening up part of the grieving process or more than that?
A little of both. The stories are all different and yet the same heartbreaking story all over again. A lot of people had been dealing with their loved one's addiction for years. This wasn't, you know, just over the past couple. So they have been on this journey, for lack of a better term, this journey of addiction with their loved one. In this case, it was all of their children.
I think the grieving process was an important aspect, but I think what was more important was the idea of intervening in someone else's life, trying to save someone. I think everyone we talked to, the common theme was if we can save one person through these obits, some good has come out of this.
When you decided to tackle the story after noticing this, there's an obituary and somebody's being very open, very frank, and oh, here's another one. How did you intend to present it going into it in both words and images? Andrew, let's start with you.
I think from the perspective of the visuals, I decided to just produce some very simple portraits of each of the families and then shoot some video for the interviews. Their stories are so powerful and so heartbreaking that I didn't really want to try to do anything to add or change that. I just wanted to allow their stories to speak for themselves.
I took a very similar track in that I just wanted to, as the writer, get out of the way and let, you know, these families tell their stories themselves. It's a very quote-driven story. I only speak to one expert. I didn't bog it down with statistics or, you know, grief experts or anything like that.
And I want to talk about that expert in just a minute. But the first person or family that you introduce us to in your report is family members of Ryan Lancelotti. Who is Ryan and what did you learn about the story?
Ryan was in his 30s.
He died in August, I believe.
He died in August, early August. His parents, one of the things they stressed to us was just his life was normal growing up. We did things as a family. We had family holidays. We're pretty sure we raised him right. He was just typical. And he still ended up in this 3-year battle with opioid addiction.
So that normalcy ended at some point.
Yeah, but I think we were both struck by how Ryan made attempts to hide it, and I think they still realized. I think that the family still knew that this was going on, but it was such a kind of hidden decline.
You used an interesting term there, Andrew, hide. 2 days after his death, the obituary appeared. His family was quite candid, and his father said, "What's there to hide anymore?" That was startling to me.
Yeah, at face value, he's right. One of the things he goes on to talk about in there is, you know, we didn't bring it up while he was living because what if he gets better and this doesn't matter anymore? And I think they slowly, over the course of those 3 years, realized he might not get better. And in the end, they said what everyone else said, you know, if this can help one person, then it'll have been worth it to just put all of this out there in black and white.
Another person you talked to for your report was Elizabeth Gilmore Jones. Her 29-year-old son, Zach, was found dead in his apartment September 2nd. When you talked to Elizabeth, was there debate within the Jones family to write the very candid obituary?
There was a little bit. When, you know, I posed the question to her, what made you want to do this? Did you ever think twice about, you know, including this in this final tribute to your son? She said she had no second thoughts, but her daughter, Zach's sister, questioned, you know, are you sure you want to put this in there? And Ms. Jones said, why wouldn't I? It's the truth. It's what happened.
I think this story and these obits are indicative of a bigger change in the way we view addiction. I think people are starting to realize that this isn't a choice, that this is a disease. And I think these obits reflect that. I think people are not feeling shame about this anymore. Shaming people who are addicted is not making the problem go away.
It's interesting that unlike the Lancelotti's, who basically revealed the addiction through the obituary, Elizabeth told you that she actually talked with some of her friends about her son's addiction prior to his death.
Right. And I think that's just, it's probably a difference in coping mechanisms. One of the things that Elizabeth Jones said to me was, you know, all of my friends went through this with me. They learned everything that I did at the Narcotics Anonymous meetings with me.
Did that help her at all, you know, having at least the empathy of friends?
She said it did. She was able to, you know, share this knowledge with friends and some family members and kind of change their view as well, that these aren't just junkies. These are people suffering from a disease, and it's a disease that doesn't discriminate at all. If it can happen to her family, it can happen to anyone.
Another person that you talk with is from the Wilkinson family, the mother, Anne, and her daughter, Kristen. Let's hear from Mark Lancelotti and Anne Wilkinson.
It's heartbreaking to know that you know they're on drugs, yet they will tell you that they're not and swear to you that they don't use, but you know.
People he would be with would die. It's like he saw it. He saw this happening. And of course, he always said that wouldn't happen to him. You know, for 3 years, we go to bed every night. And I would be expecting the doorbell to ring. This is going to be the night. This cop or somebody's going to ring the doorbell, and he's going to, you know, pass away.
Kristen was addicted from her teenage years. So you have a different story here. Anne asked her daughter, who was dying. It wasn't a sudden death from a quick overdose. She was dying because of the physical ailments that were caused by years and years and years of drug abuse. She asked her, do you want me to tell the story?
Yeah, it's almost crazy to, you know, that would be crossing her mind at such a time when you know your daughter has only days left to live. Like, she's going to die. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I get the impression from Anne that Kristen was incredibly heartbroken about her own addiction, and the idea that someone might hear this, someone might see what she's going through in the last few days of her life, and maybe change direction in their life. I think that was really powerful.
Right, and to, you know, make that decision as you're lying there dying, I can't even fathom that. I think it just goes to show what kind of toll this takes on the people who suffer from addiction and the choices that you're faced with.
I also find it interesting that Kristen recognizes the toll that it was taking on her mother and the toll on her family. And everyone who's going through this addiction is going through that. The families are going through the same thing. And Kristen recognized that and wanted to try and help other families in the last few days of her life.
Megan, you mentioned earlier in our conversation that you decided, I'm only going to speak to one expert. I'm only going to talk to one expert because it's the family's stories that should, you know, carry this report. You talked with Katie Falzone from Legacy.com. What does Legacy do?
It's kind of just an international online clearinghouse for obituaries. when you submit an obituary to a news outlet, newspaper, they all kind of end up on this website, legacy.com.
And so Katie Falzone has been noticing a trend of more people, or what, telling the stories of their loved ones, frankly, through the obituaries?
Yeah, more and more very frank, very honest obituaries, particularly when it comes to addiction and overdose deaths. More people choosing to address this. And she said that kind of sparked a conversation among everyone there at legacy.com. And a lot of it goes back to an active push to try to do away with the stigma that is attached to addiction.
Okay. So these frank, open obituaries, do some of the family members consider this an act of courage, since there still remains a stigma about these drugs? Or do they not view it as courage? It's just honesty.
I think the consensus was really, you know, just honesty. Ann Wilkinson actually says, you know, people have called me brave, but I don't think I'm brave. I just want to tell Kristen's story and help other people. And that was really kind of the consensus among all the families that we spoke to.
From both of you in our final minute, from your conversations with these individuals, do they expect more families will share their stories in this manner? What are their hopes?
Well, one thing that several of the families said actually was, you know, when they kind of came out with this and put this out there for everyone to see, the number of people who reached out to them, friends, acquaintances, who said, you know, this is happening in my life too, people they never would have expected.
I think all the families are just hoping for some, you know, one good thing to sort of come out of this. That is a source of solace for them, that one positive thing could come out. One person might see it. You know, one family might see this and hopefully, you know, change direction before this ends.
Megan Goose is a reporter and Andrew Russell, photojournalist with the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Their major story on the growing trend of addressing addiction and overdose deaths in the obituaries of loved ones was published Thursday online by the Trib. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Legislation in Congress and in Harrisburg would restrict abortions to no later than 20 weeks. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the 9th Street or Rachel Carson Bridge opens in 1926. It's one of the three sister bridges in Pittsburgh, along with the Andy Warhol and Roberto Clemente. The trio are historically significant because they were the first self-anchored suspension bridges built in the U.S. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for December 1st, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Roe versus Wade was decided 44 years ago, but access to the rights it provided are still among the most heavily debated in American politics, both across the country and here in Pennsylvania. How will today's Supreme Court justices handle those questions? What's the state of abortion access in the Pittsburgh area and across the Commonwealth? Joining us by phone to talk about these issues is Jessica Mason Piclo, senior legal analyst for Rewire, a nonprofit journalism group publishing online. Welcome, Jessica.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me.
As always, your questions and comments are welcome. Please tweet them and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. I'm going to start, Jessica, from your perspective. Has the debate over women's rights in general and access to abortion specifically intensified in the past year?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what we are seeing really from 2010 on, and in particular taking an uptick in different types of activity, is a renewed laser focus on rolling back as far as possible, and even in some instances, recriminalizing abortion access care and providers. And we had a brief victory in Whole Woman's Health, the Hellerstedt, that most recently struck some of those restrictions. But the anti-choice movement and anti-choice lawmakers have quickly pivoted, regrouped, and are absolutely honing in on restricting access even further from the very top of our government all the way through state and local entities.
I want to talk about both, you know, a couple different branches here of government and their approaches, what's new in the abortion rights issue, legislatively and judicially. As you know, former Pittsburgh area congressman Tim Murphy resigned after it became known that he supposedly asked his mistress to consider having an abortion. It turns out she was not pregnant, but and also it was pointed out, his critics said this was very hypocritical. There's been a billboard campaign, even though he has resigned, against former Congressman Murphy. Have you seen other such things, not in a sense similar campaigns targeted against different lawmakers across the country?
Not quite with the precision that Repo Action did with that billboard. I mean, that was really an amazing coming together of quick response and advocacy, but I think you're going to see more and more of that. The reality is, as you may have seen in the billboard campaign, the restrictions that are being proposed are not by people who risk their health and their life and safety in pregnancies. Amy Hagstrom-Miller is the director of Whole Woman's Health in Texas, and she came up with a saying that I think is very apt, and that most people will support abortion rights in the cases of rape, incest, or me. And it's the me part, I think, that the billboard campaign really gets to, which is this is very easy from a rhetorical standpoint to invoke all sorts of lofty language and ideals that are really grounded in a fear of reproductive autonomy, particularly for women, and the reality when faced with the consequences of their own action is to seek out the very procedures that they are demonizing, shaming, and trying to criminalize others for using.
Okay, I want to ask you about this legislation, because on that the same day that these reports about former Congressman Murphy came out, he voted for the 20-week abortion ban. And so first of all, what is the status of that federal legislation? Because there's also a 20-week abortion ban piece of legislation, actually two, in Pennsylvania. So can you tell us federally what the status is?
The 20-week ban in Congress is still in committee and it hasn't moved yet. They've been focused on some other things, for example, like the tax bill right now. But we can expect to see that start to get some momentum and move forward, whether or not it actually passes. We will see. We definitely have a Congress that is very hostile to abortion rights. And if we look to other states, we may have a sense of what their playbook is here. Ohio is a perfect example of that. So back in 2009, I believe, or right around there, when John Kasich was governor, Ohio lawmakers did the following. They introduced two different types of abortion restrictions based on gestational age. The first was a 20-week ban, like we are seeing in Congress and that you mentioned in Pennsylvania. And then the second was a 6-week ban called a heartbeat ban. And the premise behind that was that really life begins as soon as the heart begins beating. Now, any person with a biomedical background will tell you you put cardiac cells in a petri dish and they beat, and that's not necessarily considered life. But that is the basis of it. And so what they did in Ohio was they introduced these two bills pretty much at the same time and played them off against each other. So they said, well, even though they're both pre-viability bans, which Roe v. Wade and all of its progeny from there says is fundamentally unconstitutional, lawmakers play them against each other and say the 20-week ban is actually the reasonable restriction, and it's usually grounded under the guise that a fetus feels pain at that point, which the medical evidence is absolutely to the contrary. And quite frankly, the most painful experience that a developing pregnancy will go through is birth, but that's a different conversation. And then as a result, what John Kasich did was sign the 20-week bill as a quote-unquote compromise, even though they knew the 6-week was never going to pass. And so I expect to see some shenanigans like that because what we've seen is the anti-choice movement really field tests its restrictive policies in the state and then balloons them up to the federal. So there will be that. And since Whole Woman's Health, the Hellerstad, and the loss that the anti-choice movement had on what I would consider supply-side restrictions in terms of restrictions on clinics in the manner that they operate that are designed to close clinics, we will see a pivot to this sort of focus on the promotion of what the law considers advancing fetal life. And that's a really still murky and untested area of abortion rights jurisprudence, and one that I think we'll see really focused in the coming years.
Jessica, we're going to try to bring in Rebecca Addison with Pittsburgh City Paper, who's written about these issues in the Pittsburgh area. Rebecca, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Rebecca, we're talking about both federally and statewide, since there's legislation regarding the 20-week ban. Right now, the state Senate has passed a bill, 32-18, I believe was the bill, was the vote, and it's sitting in the House Health Committee. What have you been focusing on regarding the legislation and the overall issue?
So according to my sources, there is potential for the House to take up that legislation as early as this month. The House had previously passed a form of 20-week ban legislation already. So, you know, activists are predicting that they would pass this one as well. But ultimately, people are saying that, you know, it still is subject to approval by Governor Wolf, and they're thinking that he would probably veto it.
I want to mention the Senate bill. The sponsor, Republican Senator Michelle Brooks of Mercer County, quoted when she was arguing on the Pennsylvania Senate floor, she quoted a 1992 Supreme Court ruling that had at the time upheld much of Pennsylvania's Abortion Control Act. Quote, today viability is around 23 or 24 weeks, or at some moment eventually event slightly earlier in the pregnancy as it may, fetal respiratory capacity can somehow be advanced in the future, end quote. So Brooks argued that medical advancements have accomplished that over the last 25 years.
Due to major scientific advancements that have occurred over the past 25 years, it changes the viability or when a fetus or a baby can survive from 6 months to 5 months.
Okay, from each of your reporting, how big of a role does viability play and the medical advances possibly leading to earlier viability of the fetus? How big of a role does that play? Jessica, we're going to start with you, then Rebecca.
Sure. Well, viability is an important foothold in the legal analysis because that is where the court has said that the state at viability has an increasingly amount of power to regulate and in some cases even ban altogether abortions. And so that is the point at which the anti-choice movement has latched onto as a way to roll back. Now, viability is typically considered to be around 24 weeks, but as the law has made very clear, there is no, and as science shows, there's no bright line viability test. Each pregnancy is viable at its own particular stage. And so that is one consideration. The other consideration is that the rollback of, or, you know, as scientific, as medicine advances and as gestational age in terms of viability becomes more and more possible to deliver a baby earlier at, say, 22 or 23 weeks and have that baby survive, that there's still very little information in terms of the overall long-term impacting cost and care. So an extremely premature neonate is, you know, may be able to be born alive and successfully live for a little while, but that's not necessarily a given outcome. And so, you know, talking about the idea of viability in a vacuum or focusing only on one particular, fixed marker is antithetical to what science tells us and antithetical to how the law tells us we are supposed to look at these types of restrictions.
Rebecca, Jessica Semler of Planned Parenthood told you that legislation such as this could lead women who don't want abortions to have them and prevent women who do from actually seeking medical care. What did she mean by that?
Right. So, I mean, I think that the problem activists have with things with what people are saying about, you know, the viability is that the people who have many people who have abortions after 20 weeks are not doing so because these were not wanted pregnancies. You know, these are people who wanted pregnancies in most cases. And at 20 weeks is when you can find out if there are fetal and not abnormalities affecting the baby. And so they're making these decisions because these babies might not be viable. So it's not about the time that the gestational period, it's about whether or not these babies are going to survive outside of the womb. And lots of times people are making these decisions because their doctors are telling them that they will not. So having just a broad ban that says, that sets a time limit and says, you know, this is the cutoff period, doesn't take into account all the varying medical factors that these women are experiencing.
Local doctors have been weighing in on this issue in the past and still doing. Producer Megan Harris talked to a gynecologist at McGee for a story earlier this year.
We know that before abortion was legalized in America, there was the same number of abortions every year. The legalization of Roe was not the beginning of abortion in America. The legalization of Roe was the end of women dying from abortions in America. And that's really important to understand. If abortion access is taken away, if the legality of abortion is taken away, women are going to go back to trying to self-induce abortions. And that's already happened in this country. That is already happening in many areas of this country. In this state, women live hundreds of miles away from their closest abortion provider. And the prospect of driving, paying for a tank of gas is a real barrier. Many insurance companies do not cover abortion, which means women pay out of pocket for that service. It is the law that women who are on state-funded insurance cannot have abortions covered, which means that our women of the lowest socioeconomic status have the least access to essential health care. And absolutely, I've literally been laying awake at night worrying about it.
All right, we have less than 2 minutes left. I want to get your quick reactions to this. Let's start with Jessica.
Absolutely. I second everything. And in fact, we're starting to see the research. When Texas imposed its trap law, 75% of the clinics closed. And while we don't have all of the data, there is good evidence to suggest that that many women were forced to carry pregnancies to term. And along with that, there is an increase in maternal mortality rates. One of the things I think that really gets lost in this conversation is the fact that carrying a pregnancy to term is much, much more dangerous than having an abortion, particularly in the earliest stages of a pregnancy when most abortions happen. So when we talk about restricting these rights and when we talk about forcing pregnant patients to go back underground, that is not a hypothetical. We're seeing that play out right now. We're seeing women prosecuted for failed pregnancy outcomes in states like Indiana and Tennessee, and this is really concerning.
Rebecca, quickly.
Yes. An organization I talked to, New Voices for Reproductive Justice, was particularly adamant about securing funding for those low-income individuals who are on state-sponsored insurance programs who don't have the funds to have an abortion, even when it's medically necessary, or if this is just a choice that they're going to make. And they said specifically that there are states around the country that have set funds aside for these women so that they will increase abortion access there. And that's something that they're hoping that Pennsylvania will follow suit with.
10 seconds for each of you. Chances of federal legislation on the 20-week limit getting passed, after all, 2018 is election year. Chances of federal legislation getting passed. Jessica, 10 seconds.
Well, I mean, we know that they will certainly try and they will fundraise off it. And so depending on how the midterm elections go for abortion rights supporters, this is definitely a cause of concern.
And yes or no chances, Rebecca, at the state level?
I'm going to say at the state level that because of the veto, we're not going to see it actually come to fruition.
All right. Very good. Rebecca Addison is a news editor for Pittsburgh City Paper. And we also were joined today by Jessica Mason-Piklo, senior legal analyst for Rewire. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Our engineer for The Confluence is Tom Hurley. Research and production assistance from Courtney Harrell. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.